The documentary that's playing on PBS is called Children of Giant. Right. You are the actual child of the giant director. I know the reason that the PBS is airing the doc is you know the social significance of it.
Right.
I'd like to get into like some filmmaking techniques later, but let's talk about the social significance. I mean, this is 1956.
Yeah.
This is 6 years before even To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, this is way ahead of its time in terms of race relations. You had your dad's movie Giant and then John Ford's The Searchers, both dealing with racial, you know, prejudice in different ways, Native Americans and Latinos in the South.
Right.
But how's your dad, how did he tap into something, like, what's the secret to doing something ahead of its time? You know, it's easy to make a movie in hindsight, you know, kind of ride the wave, you know, like maybe like a 12 Years a Slave, like it's a conversation that's been going on, or Crash or something. But how do you do it, you know, like a Spike Lee, Do the Right Thing, or your dad with Giant? How do you catch the cusp before it's happening?
Well, I think first you have to have a perspective on justice and humanity, which my father had a very solid and progressive perspective. And he'd just come back from the war where he'd been filming combat from D-Day on through the end of the war and into the concentration camp at Dachau.
Was he with Wyler and all those guys shooting in the war?
Well, he had his own unit. General Eisenhower put him in charge of combat photography for the war in Europe, and they went on D-Day and covered it all the way to the end. So he had a point of view, and the story of the Mexican-American boy in Giant, played by Sal Mineo, mm-hmm. called Angel Obregon, mm-hmm. It was a boy who grew up on the Great Riata Ranch. And Dad changed that story a little bit, because in the story, Angel Obregon goes to war and comes back, and his story goes on. But Dad had Angel Obregon come back in a flag-draped coffin. And the funeral of Angel Obregon is one of the most touching moments in the film.
It's the notion sort of, you know, if he can fight and die for our country, why can't he just be afforded basic rights?
Right. And that's a, you know, a perspective that my father picked up during the war. He remembered a Life magazine story about coffins coming back from overseas. So I think that's how somebody taps into that and decides you're making this movie, that's going to be an important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Sal Mineo character and serving your country is one aspect. There's also, you know, with the Dennis Hopper character, he takes a Latina wife. Elizabeth Taylor's, you know, the mother is a little more accepting of it because she's sort of the progressive thinker. Mm-hmm. And this is 11 years before Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Your dad's way ahead of its time on multiple things.
Yeah, he understood the human condition. And he saw the drama in that. And it is the story of Rock Hudson, the king of this ranch down in Texas, who's a good man, but he's kind of set in ways, certain ways. And it's the story really of him becoming a bigger person through his marriage to the Eastern girl, Elizabeth Taylor.
I think she's from Maryland in the movie, right?
Yes.
Local tie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've always viewed the, you know, Rock Hudson character, it's, in a way, it's almost like, it's got the size and scope and spectacle of a Gone with the Wind, but almost the answer to it in terms of now finally the social justice has caught up to, you know, what's addressed in that.
Yeah, this Rock Hudson growing up, you know, and he has his dreams for his family, and he's shocked when his son, played by Dennis Hopper, marries the Latina, played by Elsa Cardenas. And then he ends up, at the end of the film, he's there with his wife, looking back on his life, and there's a playpen, mm-hmm. and there's his two grandchildren, little blonde girl and a little Hispanic boy.
And behind him, there's a white sheep and a black sheep. Your dad was really genius with some of that symbolism.
Yeah.
That's mise-en-scène, folks. Absolutely. And then right before that, remember, there's the scene in the diner.
Yes.
Talk about how pivotal a scene that is, because for the whole movie, you might think the title Giant is just because it's a giant spectacle movie or a giant ranch or, you know, James Dean on these giant oil rigs or, you know, but it's in the scene in the diner. And then when he's laying there bruised and battered in Elizabeth Taylor's arms, looking at the two, you know, mixed race kids that you're talking about, that the title finally comes into being, how you become a giant.
That was a scene created for the movie. It wasn't in the book. Or I believe the scene was in the book, but the Rock Hudson character wasn't in the scene. Yeah. And that they go into this diner, and there's a big guy named Sarge who runs the diner, and there's four Mexican Americans, elderly couple, and come in and sit down, and Sarge tells them to get out, and Vic says, you know, Sarge, I think you ought to let those people stay. And he tells him to mind his own business. And Vic starts his fist fight. Yeah. And it's a titanic fist fight. And he gets knocked into the jukebox and it sets off the music. And
Is it Yellow Rose of Texas? Or it's something like, it's some Southern anthem, yeah.
Yeah, the Yellow Rose of Texas. And these two huge men fight. And Vic, man in his approaching 60, ends up on his back, salad all over him, and Sarge throws the sign on him, "We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone."
Yeah, and that's, we saw that play out throughout the Civil Rights era. I mean, yeah. If you like Selma, check out Giant. I mean, it's these movies have been made for a long time.
Right.
It's such a powerful movie in that regard. And you mentioned, you know, we were talking about the playpen, and we started going into how your dad populated it with, you know, the colored sheep in the background. Mm-hmm. He used directorial techniques to really work on your subconscious, I think, a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a scene earlier on when Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson are talking, and I think they're arguing about whether a white doctor can tend to one of the Latina babies. I think that winds up being Salminio. I'm pretty sure the baby grows up.
That's
yes,
right.
Okay. So earlier on, when he's first born, they're arguing over this, and it's subtle, but I think it works subconsciously. Whenever Elizabeth Taylor's talking, it's really brightly lit, but then when he goes for the reverse shot on Rock Hudson, it's really dark, and it almost cues us in who we're supposed to sympathize with. I don't know, did you ever pick up on that, or is that just
I don't recall. I don't recall that, but it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Check it out next time. I want to give your dad credit for it. But another cool thing was, what is it, when Mercedes McCambridge, who later voiced The Exorcist, right, here in D.C., she's riding on her death ride on the horse. Your dad uses that right before she's bucked off. We go from this extreme wide shot, and you talk about that in your book, extreme wide shot to that really close up on the spur. I mean, talk about your dad in terms of a daring filmmaker in that regard, to just kind of break rules like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they used to say he made his films in the editing room. You know, he'd shoot a lot of film, and then he'd look for the best way to tell the story. And, you know, that's instinct, you know, to do something that's going to arrest the audience's attention and have that foreboding that... all is not well in this horse ride.
Did you view him like that throughout his career? Just to be able, you know, I'm going to break a rule here every now and then. I mean, it's a traditional storytelling structure most of the time. It's not French New Wavey or anything, you know, but every now and then there's those little things spur.
He was very imaginative at using the screen, you know, the moving image. And he did it usually... not to call attention to itself. I mean, the lawn dissolves in A Place in the Sun. We're talking about another movie now. Mm-hmm. But he would use the full force of the medium. Mm-hmm. But he also had an expression, he never wanted the audience to be looking at the picture and be thinking about the cameraman with his hat on backwards riding the crane.
Noticing the process.
The picture, yeah.
But no, I mean, that's an admirable thing to want to remain invisible and you're not being flashy. But at the same time, he is, you know, it's not a cop out either. He's actually doing stuff subconsciously on you. You're just not always noticing it, which I think is part of his genius.
Right.
I think. I mean, there's all, you know, this the he's in the conversation of the great directors, right? There's like everyone else, there's a little more people, and then there's the greats. So he's always obviously up here. But among the greats, I've always found him, like, I think he's a little underrated. I think he needs even more esteem up among the Hitches and the Fords.
I think that one of the things is Hitchcock, you know, the master of suspense. Mm-hmm. John Ford, he made great westerns.
Right.
Ford did more than that.
Right.
My father just played the full spectrum of comedy, drama, adventure. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gunga Din, the more the merrier.
Astaire Rogers.
Swing Time, the best Astaire Rogers film of all. And so he never wanted to be pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's easier for the critics if they can pigeonhole somebody.
Slap a label on you.
And wrap it up and tie a ribbon around it. And he has more dimension than that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, with a picture like Giant, you have... That's like a big, you know, social conscious, you know, Stanley Kramer style, you know, social justice movie. But with like a Gone with the Wind lavish spectacle. But then, also James Dean's last movie. But then with A Place in the Sun, you have this wonderful romance. Those tight shots with Montgomery Clift and Liz Taylor kissing. And but it's also like a thriller and a courtroom drama. Yeah. I mean, he could do everything. My favorite shot in A Place in the Sun, when Monty Clift gets done sleeping with Shelley Winters and he's leaving the place. Your dad just goes in on that radio, right?
Yeah.
And it goes from night to day on that radio.
And the chilling sound of the factory whistle going off.
Yeah.
You know, it affects you.
Yeah.
You know, physically. I mean, it's ominous.
He found ways to do sights and sounds to convey stuff that, you know, in a modern movie today, a lot of filmmakers probably would just show them, you know, they're making love right on screen and it'd be this salacious thing, 50 Shades of Grey or whatever. But isn't there an art to be able to convey that with a whistle or an alarm clock fading from night to day that's more artful, I think?
And a remarkable scene in A Place in the Sun is when Shelley Winters goes to see the doctor. And you couldn't talk about abortion. You couldn't use the word. And it says everything, you know, with this old doctor and you know, there's a subtlety that lets the audience do a lot of the work. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a role to play in that scene.
I think that's a key. I think filmmakers need to give the audience more credit. Like, I think they're up to the challenge more than you think. I mean, do you think your dad viewed it as...
He did.
I don't need to do hand-holding.
You know, there used to be the studio mantra in the old days was, you know, the audience has the intelligence of 10-year-olds or, you know. And I have often said, what did you learn working with your father for many years I did, and my answer is respect for the audience, that he respected the audience and gave him credit for being able to be partners in his telling of the story. And that's, you know, I've always felt was a strength of mine, that I had that belief.
Absolutely.
And didn't want to talk down to them.
It's really smart. And a good lesson to pass down. Where were you? I mean, we've talked a lot about your dad's career because it's so legendary, but where were you along the way here? I mean, how old are you when he's making, let's say, Shane? Are you Brandon DeWild? You're older than that.
I was older than that. But the summer before he made Shane was my first summer in college, and I worked for him, and I had two jobs. One was to break down Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy.
Wow.
List every scene in part one and part two.
Became A Place in the Sun, right?
Yeah. Right. And the other was to read books that came from the studio or screenplays. And one day I read his book, a lot of junk, you know. And this small book came and I read it. And I went to see my father that night. He was in bed reading. And I said, you know, I read this story this afternoon. I thought, I think it's a really good story. I said, you ought to read it. And he said, well, why don't you tell me the story? So I was kind of pacing around his bed trying to tell him the story of Shane.
Oh, wow.
And the next summer I worked with him on it. And then that's me there in that top of those two photographs with Rock Hudson on Giant. I was in the Air Force when Giant was made.
Wow.
But I visited it quite a bit.
What was it like to, I mean, where'd you read the Shane article or the book?
No, it was a book.
But do you remember where you picked it up? Like, how did you stumble?
It came from the studio.
Okay,
with a bunch of stuff.
I got you.
Yeah.
So what's it like to be pacing around that bedroom? He's in bed right now, and you're walking around, and you're reciting the story of Shane. That's just that's unreal.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, he was a great man and a great father, but you know, he was going to read the book, but I think he thought it was probably good batting practice. Right. Let me think.
Yeah.
It put you in the position of telling a story.
Right.
And
did you have Alan Ladd in your mind when you were...
No. In fact, there's in Dad's copy of the book, I gave all his papers to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, where I'm giving my papers. Mm-hmm. And on the scene... where Jack Schaefer writes about the chopping the stump.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And Dad wrote in this margin, Monty will have to muscle up for this scene.
So he thought it would be Monty Clift.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the first idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just got off a movie with him, I guess.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I know you weren't the Wild's age, but... I've always just in terms of the career, I've always pictured you like that, watching your dad, you know, like your dad's Shane, watching your hero and then learning from it. Let's go a little bit more into your career too, because, you know, your dad has left a huge legacy, obviously. But I mean, just like I was telling you with your two books here, the great movie Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age. I mean, you did these in conjunction with American Film Institute, right?
Well, you know, one of my career, I came here having worked in Hollywood, worked with my father last on The Diary of Anne Frank, and we were about to start The Greatest Story Ever Told. And then Edward R. Murrow asked me to come and work with him at the USIA, United States Information Agency, under Kennedy. And I ran the motion picture program there. And during that time, the National Endowment for the Arts was created, and they didn't know what to do about film. Mm-hmm. And my advice was asked, and I suggested a film institute. And so then I became the founder of the Film Institute. Did that for...
The fact that you founded that is just mind-blowing. I mean, that's... The AFI, I think, has done more... This is, you know, biased opinion, but I think done more to just generate... you know, film conversation and inspire young people to get into with all the best lists and, you know, the countdowns they do and the AFI Silver and Silver Diet and just everything. I think they've just, it's just a priceless institution. Yeah. And I just want to say thank you for doing it.
You're welcome.
How'd that come about? Do you remember the first mentioning?
Yeah, well, I had, having come to Washington, realized that there was very little awareness about the value and potential of film. The film wasn't the center of the conversation the way it is now, and nobody knew the names of any directors, you know, and it was sort of fashionable to say, oh, I never go to the movies, you know, sort of a little East Coast thing there.
Right.
And as the idea for the endowment developed, you know, I had been at the USIA. I started an intern program and a young filmmakers program to bring younger filmmakers into USIA. So I was on that track.
Right.
That, you know, and that the European countries had great film schools and we didn't. And we didn't preserve our films and they were disappearing and deteriorating.
Rotting away.
Yeah. So, you know, the Film Institute was kind of organic to me when the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah. Are you amazed to see how it's continued to flourish?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pleased that You know, I spent 12 years on it, which was longer than I intended, and then stayed on the board till today.
Yeah.
But I couldn't devote my life to it. I had other stuff to do. So, you know, there's some things that we started a wonderful magazine called American Film, and that kind of collapsed, which was a shame. And one of my ideas was that there would be a museum on the mall dedicated to film. You know, so some of the dreams I had never got fulfilled. But
is it possible that could ever happen? Or,
well, I think they're now doing it in Hollywood. I think, it would take a lot of engineering and political effort.
Well, I guess they kind of spread it out. They got Dorothy Slippers. Mad Men was just here with some stuff. But they kind of spread it out. I think Katharine Hepburn's Oscars are at, like, National Portrait Gallery or something. But I think it would be cool to have them all in one place. But, you know, you and I are biased on that subject. just more on the AFI. I mean, I mentioned the 100 Year series. I'm a huge fan of those. I mean, it gives you a great primer. And not only just, you know, if you want, you can print off the list and go down with a highlighter, like I did. But the television specials, you would get all of these filmmakers around, and you got to see, you know, why Spielberg loved The Searchers, why Scorsese loved, you know, whatever, the Citizen Kane, looking at it through the cinematic eye. And, you know, those series, I mean, this is just personal opinion, but, like, I feel like those in really can serve as a great primer for new generations to come.
It's important. I mean, to respect the history of this medium, which is largely a product of America in the 20th century, and to respect that and to be knowledgeable about it, it's important.
And view it as an art form. I mean, it's art and entertainment. It's that whole, the spectrum, which I think your dad nailed too. We're not even going to even try to go through all the conversations you've had in the book. If you guys don't know, TOP listeners, Mr. Stevens Jr. here has had done a series of Q&As he's compiled with every major filmmaker you can imagine, from Billy Wilder to Alfred Hitchcock to John Ford, and even newer ones. I think the second book has, like, Darren Aronofsky and some newer guys too.
Yes.
If I shoot out a name, could you just tell me a thought? Like, you know, Capra.
He's a remarkable fellow. You know, he was born in Italy and came to the United States and ended up making the most loved films of the 30s and early 40s, and he was about 5'7" and a feisty guy.
Yeah.
And
also shot like your father, right? Well, shot in war.
He headed up in Hollywood the Why We Fight series, and Dad told me when Capra came to the Pentagon one time. As I said, he was not a big man. He was a lieutenant colonel. And he came to talk to them about this movie program. And they walked in, and there were 10 generals. And they had all their, and admirals. And they had all their uniforms on and all on a big conference table. Yeah. And he shook hands with all of them, and they were all very polite. And he's in his colonel's uniform, lieutenant colonel. And finally it quieted down. He says, "Well, fellas," he says, "are we going to talk about motion pictures?" And they said, "Yes." He says, "Then I'll sit at the head of the table."
Awesome.
So that's Frank Capra.
I love that story. All right. All right. And God, Alfred Hitchcock.
He was so brilliant at being specific about how movies are made.
Yeah.
And he was contrary, and he would talk about that it's all preparation.
Yeah.
And he said that when I walk onto the set to start shooting a movie, I've made the movie in my head.
He's already seen it.
He said, yes. And I'm really kind of bored to have to shoot it.
Yeah.
And he said, well, then why don't you let somebody else shoot it? And he said, "I don't want them to screw it up."
It's true.
Yeah.
So that encapsulates him.
Yeah.
Your book said it a little bit. I taught a class at AU last summer with little high schoolers wanting to see if they want to go into film. And your book settled a debate we had over Vertigo, what the green and the reds meant. And I thumbed through it and found I'm going to let listeners, you have to go look up the book. But it plays into the eternal, you know, the redwoods and, you know, the green ever living. It's mm-hmm. it's Judy, it's Madeline staying alive. And so your book solved that one for us. So thank you. Great. Billy Wilder.
Well, Billy Wilder, again, what's so remarkable about that era of motion pictures, that some of the funniest films, Some Like It Hot, to name one.
Yeah.
Made by this fellow who was born in Vienna and spoke with an Austrian accent till the day he died. But how the immigrant enriched this unique American kind of form of motion picture comedy.
Yeah.
And Billy Wilder and before him Ernst Lubitsch.
Yeah, they worked together.
And others.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's... we think it's the American, it is the American Film Institute, but it's not all American natives. I mean, it's a lot of immigrant direct. I mean, even Hitchcock, we just mentioned, is from England, and all over the place.
William Wyler. Yeah.
What stood out with you from your chat with William Wyler? First thing that comes.
Well,
we were
good friends, and you know, he had gone also into the army like my father, and he flew missions in B-25s over Germany, making a film called The Memphis Belle.
Mm-hmm.
He lost his hearing in one of those, attack on the plane he was flying in.
Maybe that's where George Bailey got it. That was Capra.
Or Brian Williams.
Yeah. True.
That Willie was, again, not a big man, but, you know, with an accent.
Yeah.
And a great colleague of my father's. In fact, Frank Capra and William Wyler and my father started a company together.
Mm-hmm.
They were all lieutenant colonels
mm-hmm.
after the war. And that, you know, Wyler, born in Toulouse, France,
mm-hmm.
and comes to America and has a great career,
mm-hmm.
and gives it up to join the army, to go back to Europe
mm-hmm.
and risk his life. You know, these were great men.
Yeah. You feel like the same isn't asked of our celebrities today.
No.
It's a smaller and smaller percentage that goes and fights such wars.
Yeah. But more concerned with organic food.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I don't know. Any I'm trying to think who all else is. I mean, we don't want to go through all of them, but John Ford.
John Ford was Sean Aloysius O'Feeney. Was his name. And I think he was born in Maine of Irish parents. And he was older than these ones mm-hmm. that we talked right. about a little bit, but colleagues, also fought in World War II. He just had this great Irish-American sensibility that applied to Westerns or comedies. And there was just tremendous heart in his work.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved, you know, American history and had a way of presenting it.
And a lot of the people we've talked about were kind of the golden age, so to speak, of your dad's generation of filmmakers.
Yes.
As that torch got carried into, you know, sort of the more maverick, you know, Easy Riders to Raging Bulls phase, or I'd put it at 67 probably, right? Mm-hmm. Bonnie and Clyde graduate on, maybe. It was this new flowering of what film could do. What was your take on that whole era? I mean, different from your father's generation, but great filmmaking in a whole new way. It was almost mm-hmm. the French coming back, inspiring them.
Yeah, that was The Godfather. There's some wonderful films in that period that, you know, I think judge filmmakers by their body of work.
You're the auteur.
William Wyler said it when we gave him the Life Achievement Award in his acceptance speech. He said, "I'm not sure whether I believe in the auteur theory," he says, "but I know I'm the only director in Hollywood who can pronounce it correctly."
There you go.
So these were men of humor.
Absolutely.
And most of them also liked a good drink or a few drinks.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the hard living bunch in those days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'd seen a lot and been through a lot. Let's say that. What about the state of cinema today? Technology has changed so much in terms of distribution, streaming online.
Yeah.
Cameras are becoming way more portable now. You know, it's now, God, someone can pull off something like Birdman and do a single take and the illusion of it, at least the whole movie. I mean, there's some cool new avenues out there. But what's your take on it? I mean, a lot of people are also hesitant on, for every Birdman, there's like 9 tentpole superhero movies too, which they obviously have a place. Where do you think we stand now? Do we need to recalibrate at all? Or you think we're healthy, or where do you think we are now?
It's very hard to guide, with the American Film Institute, mm-hmm. We had this idea that, some training and, a serious place where people could learn filmmaking from the masters, mm-hmm. which was the Center for Advanced Film Studies that we set up in Los Angeles, where David Lynch and Terrence Malick and... Mm-hmm. A lot of other wonderful filmmakers have come out of. But I think it's hard to say, we ought to insist on more of this or insist on more of that, because it is this free enterprise thing. And what interests me right now is the really high quality of work being done for television in the broadest sense. True Detective,
amazing show,
beautiful filmmaking.
And those 8 episodes can go up against a movie.
Absolutely. And that's where people who have some kind of more seriousness mm-hmm. of purpose might end up making their films and doing it very well. And you notice more and more good directors mm-hmm. doing work there.
Absolutely.
Whether it's Netflix or HBO or Showtime,
AMC,
because they can tell the stories they want to tell. And the big investment in the movie business these days, when the era where I was, when my father, Fred Zinnemann, David Lean, William Wyler, John Ford, they were making the big pictures every year. I mean, the
CinemaScopes and the VistaVisions
and the stories. Lawrence of Arabia, A Man for All Seasons, Giant. The Searchers. Now, the big investment is going to the tent poles, mm-hmm. and that's not where the great filmmakers are working. And so the films that end up getting award consideration are usually films made for much less money. I thought it was a good thing when the lion's share of the resources would go to a David Lean to make a Zhivago or a Lawrence
or a River Kwai,
or to my father to make Giant or A Place in the Sun or Shane.
How did that splintering happen? I mean, like you said, David Lean or your father would get, the big budget. What would be going now to, the tentpole movie would be going to those, what were considered the great artful filmmakers of their time. Even into the other era we're talking about, in 67 or whatever. I mean, The Graduate is a movie that's like the twilight of its era. Teenagers are going to see that, but it's probably one of the most, Mike Nichols, one of the greatest directed movies ever. So much going on in there. How did that splintering happen? I mean, kids aren't going to see the great art movies anymore. Back in the day, it was all one.
Yeah.
So how did that splintering happen? Was it the sequel era of the 80s? Was it I don't know. What do we attribute that to?
Is it Jaws gone mad?
Jaws a great film, but
that was
Sharknado.
I guess Star Wars was the one that set it off. These studios, international corporations, mm-hmm. they have found that the way to make a lot of money is to make these so-called tentpole movies and hope that they can build a theme park mm-hmm. and merchandise
right.
a lot of goods with it.
Right.
And
with the built-in brand probably of something that already exists right. before the movie, like a comic book.
And those are, for the most part, films that don't attract the best filmmakers right. because they might have, want to make something a little truer to their own mm-hmm. identity.
Personal expression.
Mm-hmm.
Personal film, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that genie... I feel like that genie's kind of out of the bottle. It's hard to, it's almost severed where, the movies that are made for the summer are making gobs of money. They're always the top grossers, but they're hardly ever around come award season. It used yeah. to be Sound of Music was the best picture and the highest grossing movie of the year. Right. Is that genie out of the bottle? Is that split going to go on and we just have to kind of,
You never know.
Yeah.
That's what led me to talk about the good work being done in television
mm-hmm.
or right. on the home screen, yeah. if you will. And, nothing is forever.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
You and I don't have the answer.
I wish we could. But, yeah, television, I think, is, mm-hmm. True Detective. Are you a binger? Are you a binge watcher?
I have done a little of it. And we have big screens at home.
Yeah.
I was watching The Masters on Sunday.
Nice.
And, the picture is just so... And I was thinking my father used to love golf.
Yeah.
It was... black and white or even color,
yeah.
but this high definition, yeah. You can have...
See the tee flying off the tee box.
Absolutely. You can have a great experience
yeah.
at home watching a movie
yeah.
That's, maybe not quite what the theater is, but it's comparable. Right. Whereas before, I'm still a big fan of the experience in a theater.
It's a communal experience, everyone in the in a dark at once. Match it.
Right.
But what's your take on film versus digital? I mean, you mentioned the HD at the Masters. I mean, these cameras can catch a lot.
Yeah, and good filmmakers are able to offset that sort of bright mm-hmm. digital
right.
quality.
Right.
But I hate to see film go away.
Yeah. Well, you started the American Film Institute. Right. It wouldn't be the same.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. Before we go,
say something about this very good film that's going to be on PBS on Children of Giant. I was helpful to the fellow Hector Galam, a Hispanic American fellow down in Texas, who had this idea of going back and revisiting Marfa, Texas, where Giant was shot
nice.
In 1956, and to see how it affected the Hispanic-American people in that area. And he's made a fascinating film, which tells you a lot about Giant and even more about life in Marfa, Texas today and race relations.
In America. Immigration is still a hot button issue. We've evolved so far, but still a ways to go on a lot of these things. So, And I think your dad will continue to look even more in a favorable light when the ahead of his time filmmaker even becomes more and more ahead of his time as more time passes.
And the one film of his that, was not a great success financially,
mm-hmm.
and one of the most ambitious films he made was The Greatest Story Ever Told, mm-hmm. The Life of Jesus, which I think over time is going to become a hugely respected film. Right. It was very respected when it came out.
But it's kind of gotten lost in the shuffle.
Well, and there were some critics who really took after it. But it's a serious telling of this story that has fascinated mankind for generations, the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
And that he made it so that it could be accepted by the believer, but also could be respected and be mm-hmm. engaging to the non-believer.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's a bit of a hidden gem now?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. It's one of the most beautiful films ever made.
Okay. God, I've seen it. I think I've seen it once, but I want to go take a look at it again. Yeah. Really? Okay. So why? I mean, why do you think? Why do you think that is? It's what's going on in that movie that stands out to you?
That's a very important story.
Yeah.
And it is told with such intelligence and such drama and such cinematic grandeur, both in the big sense and in the small sense. And you watch how, you know, you enjoy seeing how scenes are staged and how story is told. You know, this is it's a sleeper.
It's the sleeper hit. So yeah, everyone's seen Ben-Hur, but go back, maybe check out the hidden sleeper.
And I was thinking about it when on Easter, ABC ran the Ten Commandments, which they ran
annual,
every Easter, which is really kind of a bogus movie, if I dare say. You know, it's
With all due respect, Mr. DeMille.
Yes.
But so you think the greatest story ever told could be you would like to see it become that annual
if it could. Because it's informative and true and, you know, real effort to capture the what was so remarkable about this life.
Right.
And
that people are still talking about it.
Played by an extraordinary actor named Max von Sydow. Mm-hmm. Who,
from all the Ingmar Bergman movies.
From the Ingmar Bergman films. But he was somebody you really could believe that this may be Jesus as opposed to, you know, the actors who were movie stars who played it.
Yeah, when you've sat across from death and played chess against him in an Ingmar Bergman movie, you're allowed to be Jesus, I think. I think that earns your cred.
That's right.
Well, thanks so much. We'll look forward to seeing the movie. Thanks. Great. It's my pleasure.
Okay, wonderful.